Hi, I'm Terry Snowden. Welcome to the Forever Mancunians series here on the Forever Manchester podcast platform. In each episode, we bring you an interesting and inspirational conversation with local people doing extraordinary things in our communities. My guest is Rod Maxwell from local community radio station Radio Alti.
Hey Terry, what about you?
What about you, mate?
Very well, thank you.
Now, I'm going to try a three-pronged approach to our little chat today, Rod. I'm going to talk about you, I'm going to talk about the situation that you suddenly found yourself in, and then we're going to talk about your involvement in community radio and the many benefits that that can bring. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, before we get into all the nitty-gritty, tell me something about yourself and life before community radio came into your world. I can tell that's not a Manchester accent.
It's not, no, it's a Downpatrick, County Down, Northern Ireland accent. So I was born actually on the day Jimi Hendrix died, 18th of September 1970.
Wow.
But I'm not a rocker, and I'm not really great at guitar like him. But I grew up in a town called Downpatrick, which is south of Belfast, famous for the Saint. That's where he was buried, and also famous for bands like Ash, for example.
Okay.
During that time in the 70s and 80s, of course, Northern Ireland was a very different place, and I was very fortunate to always have music in my life. So I sang actually in a cathedral choir. I was a treble, and then my voice broke quite early, so from the age of 14 I was singing as a tenor. And then I always wanted to have a band, and big in Northern Ireland those days were cover bands, you know, going around covering anything. And so from about 16 I started with a cover band, and we would go around pubs and play and that type of stuff. And then I left Northern Ireland in 1989, like so many of my friends, to go to university.
And where was university?
I went to Edinburgh. Yeah, so I thought about Manchester. I did like the football club. And to be honest with you, in those days, we hardly ever went to Belfast. So moving from a small provincial town to any city was a big move. And so I took the sort of interim step of going to Edinburgh and studying business there for 4 years. And got to like the city. Never thought I was going to stay there, and I didn't. But probably learnt more about business working in pubs than actually doing the course.
Really?
Yeah. A good mate of mine, he's from East Belfast, him and I ran a pub together for a while. And in that period, I probably learnt more about business than I did the 4 years of my course, if I'm honest with you. And then got a job working for a management consultancy firm. They were based here. They had a base here in Manchester by the airport. And they had London. And then I thought, I'm not ready for London. I need another interim step. And so I thought, right, Manchester. And we were sent to Chicago to train, because you were computer programming those days in big mainframe computer programming language. Not many of us had an ounce of knowledge about computers beforehand, but you were a blank canvas, really.
Right.
And you went and you trained both in London and then in Chicago. And I was part of the Manchester office, but had never really been to Manchester that much. Oldham a few times, but didn't know where to live or whatever. And four of us, one English guy, two Scots guys and myself, ended up getting a house here in Hale, would you believe?
In Hale.
Only because the company had one free and we took on the lease. And that was December 1993. And I've been based in Manchester area ever since. 30 years now.
I think you're the first person I've ever met who was actually employed by a Manchester company but based in Chicago that never actually set foot in Manchester.
In the 20 odd years that I worked, I did a little bit of work for the co-op. I did quite a bit of work for AstraZeneca out towards Macclesfield. But I was mostly always away from this area. I spent most of my time on the road going to Europe or London or to Scotland.
And was it a sales-based role or service-based?
No. I started out, ironically, computer programming. And again, as I said, didn't know too much about it. I'm not sure I know any more now. But in those days, companies like Barclays were putting in big computer programming systems, and I was working for a company who did those jobs. And you would go away for 12 months, 2 years, working on client site, putting these systems in. And it took a long time, you know. So I worked in different industries. I worked in insurance. I did some time in manufacturing. I spent quite a lot of time in retail. And that was actually down in London for about 4 years. And then I did a bit of time in pharmaceuticals and worked in Europe.
Life suddenly came to a sudden and abrupt. Something happened, didn't it?
Yeah. In 2016, I was starting to feel a bit weird. When I say a bit weird, I was losing track of things that I would normally not lose track of. And I put it down, if I'm honest, to stress of work. I had just been promoted in the company. I was a partner in a consultancy business. And I just thought, actually, I'm putting too much pressure on myself here, trying to be the role. And then I was traveling away, back and forth to London or different places. And I think it was around the end of September 2016, I left London early one day because the pain in my head had got to the point where it felt like somebody was banging a six-inch nail right into my front temple. And I couldn't concentrate at all.
On anything, I would imagine.
No, I was really, and I don't remember the journey home on the train at all. And I came home and my wife said, "What's up?" And I went, "I'm just feeling a bit tired and stuff." You know, I did that stupid meal thing of like brushing it off. And next morning I woke up and I was, this where we're sitting now was my home office. And I sat down here about 8 in the morning and I couldn't see the computer screen properly. You know, I just couldn't concentrate. And I went back to my wife, Ellie, and I said, "I need to go and see a GP. I need to go and see a doctor." And literally 15 minutes after the phone call, I was with the GP, and a very young GP. And she sat there and she listened to my wife, you know, downloading all her concern. And then she talked to me and I just went, just feeling a bit stressed, you know. And I didn't really understand what was going on. Maybe I didn't want to admit it. But she was very perceptive and she sent me straight to Withenshaw. And by lunchtime, I was lying in a MRI machine. And again, even though my memory is bad, I can still visualize and hear that machine as I lay there. You know, you're in a tunnel and there is a big magnet going around you. And it has a mechanical sound as it does that. And even though you've got headphones on, and I remember I asked them to tune into a radio station, any radio station, and I was listening to music. But the whole time I was lying there with my head in like a vice thing. And something told me this isn't going to be good. And I don't know what it was, but that night then I was taken by ambulance. And I remember it quite well, actually, because I'd never been in an ambulance before. And they moved me from Withenshaw to Salford Royal, which, you know, is a fantastic health unit and has a specific neuro department. And we're very lucky in Manchester to have such good NHS facilities, got to say that. And I got to Salford Royal, and then they did some tests over the next couple of days and confirmed that I had a brain tumour in the base of my brain.
Right.
There's a cavity there, and they said, "Well, we've got to operate." So that was 2016.
Wow. Now I guess that for some, especially some people experiencing major trauma such as that, life becomes very different very, very quickly. And can present, I should imagine, a very different range of new and unexpected challenges.
I think there's two scenarios I use when I try to describe what it's like. Because I was very fortunate that the NHS looked after me physically. And I, you know, if we hadn't got the expertise and the skills of both the theatre staff, the surgeon and the medical staff looking after you in the ward, you know, I was at their mercy, and they were brilliant, right? But it's a bit like an earthquake, in that if you can get through the epicenter of the earthquake, which is your time in hospital, I also often think it's the aftershocks that get you, and you're not quite ready for what they are. And it can be very basic things. So I was told that I would never work again. And that was a real, and it still gets me emotionally, that was a real hard thing to take, Terry, because even though I tried to balance family and work, I took my work very seriously. And having just been made partner, I thought I was ready to do great things in the workplace and have opportunities to do great things. And that was gone, basically. Mm. But even simple things like I had to surrender my license and I couldn't drive a car for ages. And, you know, that taught me about independence and then vulnerability. You know, I'd walk down the street and I'd be worried in case, you know, I would get lost, for example, because my memory wasn't good. Or I just felt vulnerable because I had this massive big scar in my head.
What about other people's perceptions of you? I think my head's going, drawing me towards invisible disability here. Do you feel the need to explain yourself to people?
Yeah, well, you know,
I'm sorry if that sounds very blunt.
No. I think you make a really good point, is that in some ways people can handle physical disability and visibility that they see easier, I think, than they can handle the ones that are invisible. Again, the other scenario I use is that I soon discovered that, you know, when you're working, and in any form of work that you do, you're on the motorway of life, right? And you're that busy, and you're always thinking ahead, and you've got a trajectory, you've got a destination, and you might stop at certain service stations on the way up, but you're focused on the road ahead. And I realized that I had come off that road. I was only 46, and actually I was now not only just on an A road, I was on a B road, and I was standing watching everybody else around me, and they were just going voom, voom, voom. And you suddenly realise that people don't have time. You know, they might care about you, but they're so busy staying on that motorway that they don't necessarily have time to check in. And the first thing I realised was actually the importance of family. And I knew this, but, you know, you get reminded of the family and the very close friends and the ones who don't feel awkward about talking to you about it.
No, it's an interesting one because I'm pretty sure but most people are obviously aware of disability as a very visible thing. And despite the fact that a lot of disabilities are invisible, our reaction to them isn't very visible because obviously it's an invisible thing. We don't necessarily know how to recognise it, how to support it, how to get on with it. I mean, interestingly, for many disabled people, you know, computers are seen as a great equaliser.
Well, my main disability or my core disability is my memory. My short-term memory is not good. And I remember being in Salford Royal and there's a procedure as you're about to leave and they do basic things like they get you to make a breakfast, right, because they want to know if you've got the ability to sequence, right? And when you're doing that, it's suddenly you're thinking, right, I'm really back to basics here, you know? And my driving licence was gone and I suddenly had to get used to the fact that life had changed. And I found that actually it was the aftershocks that I struggled with most, and dealing with what was a life-changing experience and finding a new path, basically.
And I know that there's loads of things, the more you give it a think about, sometimes just telling somebody you're looking great or you're looking fine is actually a social barrier.
It's a mask.
It's absolutely, isn't it? It's just it's an interesting one. I think people are arriving, you know, at that conclusion as well, that in factories and workplaces, they often have health and safety officers. You don't often see mental health and safety officers.
I think the problem with mental health is too much voodoo still associated with it. You know, there's so many different forms of it, first of all, right? And it's not like, you know, a broken limb. I think mental health has such many different shades and varieties. And I'm no expert, right? I really don't know much about it. But I think you can't have a standard way for treating somebody, because I do think their makeup, their background, who they are as people is such an important thing. So I was prescribed psychology sessions, and I struggle with them, if I'm really honest. And I still wonder if there was a degree of arrogance, because I would turn around to them and say, can you tell me what steps we're going to go through? What's the plan, right? What's your methodology, right? Which is what in business I would have done.
It's a process.
It's a process. And I want to know, because I wanted to know where I was going to be as I went along. And they couldn't give me that. And I was going to these sessions and I was feeling almost more depressed as I went to them. And I made a very arrogant decision, and it didn't sit well with my wife, and I felt a bit awkward, but I stopped them. And I made a decision that what I needed was to meet people, to do stuff, to have a purpose in my week. And there was a couple of things that I think really saved me initially. One was I volunteered at a local charity shop in Altrincham called Headway. And Headway is a charity that specialises in helping people with brain injury. And just turning up to that shop every Thursday morning for 3 or 4 hours, and the routine of turning up. My job initially, Terry, was to go through the bags of donations, sort them out, sort through them in the back office. But the very fact I had one thing to do in my week and a reason for getting up, and you had colleagues and people to meet, made a difference. Unfortunately, I'm not doing it anymore. Partly, I'm too busy, and I stopped at lockdown. But it was the stepping stone that I needed. And the day they allowed me to work on the till, and it still gives me shivers, right? They allowed me get on the till, and I felt like Captain Kirk in the Starship Enterprise, because if you're on the till in the shop, you can see everything that's going around, and everybody who comes in who wants to buy something has to come to you, and they'll have a chat with you. And I tell you, it's the chat that I missed most about work. It's the engagement, the curiosity, community, you know, people, stories, and being on the till. It was a bit of theatre about it, right? And if they come in and they're buying something, and you can do that other thing, it's not a cracker. You've got a real bargain there type thing, you know? And then they'll talk to you and they'll give you a little bit about their life.
So you had little scripts of conversation.
You did, and little snippets. And even though I might not remember the conversation because my memory was that bad, and still is, but it was almost like something inside you just lit up, you know? And you think, well, I'm giving them something. They're having a bit of an interaction. They're having a bit of chat. And you never know when somebody's coming in, how they're feeling and what they're coming in for. You know, somebody who comes in for a cup of coffee, it's not maybe the coffee. They just need to feel part of something.
And they'll never know what they were giving you.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's for me, what community is actually about, you know. And it doesn't have to be about big gestures. It can be a wave. It can be a hello, you know. It can be a what about you. Or that's community in my mind.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Forever Mancunians. If you like the show, please follow us in your podcast app. And if you have time, leave us a review. To find out how you could work with Forever Manchester, show your support, receive a newsletter, or make a donation, check out forevermanchester.com.